started today. So it does look like that about 40% or more of our audience is coming from a consulting background. About a quarter of the audience is from the federal government. About a quarter of you are from state governments. A small fraction are joining us from the mining industry and academics, and then we have a handful of you that categorize yourself as other. So thank you so very much for providing that background information and sharing with us. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to my co-moderator, Michelle Mahoney, to provide some opening remarks for today's broadcast. Michelle?
Great. Thank you so much, Jean. I really appreciate you kicking us off today, and we have some great topics for discussion today, and we're very pleased to have two great presenters that will be introduced to you today. I wanted to start off by just making everyone aware of some resources that we have available related to cleaning up of mine sites. We have a issue area on Cluin at this website you see here, cluin.org/mining. And here we put all up-to-date information, reports, upcoming events, case studies, and things like that. We have a spotlight for news. So I would encourage you to visit this website so you can keep up to date with the type of information that we're gathering here at EPA related to cleaning up of mining sites, in particular as related to treatment technologies. As Jean mentioned, today is the third of three webinars. I just want to give some thanks and credit to Bill Lauder at the Department of Interior and also Shahid Mahmood at EPA, who really played a crucial role in pulling together the presentations that we put together for. We had an in-person meeting of the FRTR related to mining, and what has been presented in this series of three on Cluin are just part of what we pulled together at that in-person meeting. So I just want to recognize them for their input in helping us come up with some great presenters and presentations. And with that, I think I'm going to turn over now to Rosalind Ramsey, who's also assisting with the delivery of today's webinar, and she can let you know about the archives and also introduce today's speakers.
All right. Thank you, Michelle. As Michelle said, I am Rosalind Ramsey, one of the other moderators for today's webinar, and I would like to introduce today's talk and speakers. Today's webinar is the final part of a three-part series based on the presentations delivered at the Spring 2017 Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable meeting, which was focused on mining site characterization and treatment. Dr. Kate Campbell, a biochemist with USGS, and Dr. Brian Hadley, a senior photogrammist at BLM, will be presenting two techniques during this webinar, the first being best practices for monitoring, and modeling to understand fundamental biogeochemical processes at metal-rich sites in order to improve conceptual and numerical models, and two, to the use of unmanned aircraft to conduct biological surveys at mining sites. Dr. Kate Campbell is a biogeochemist with the National Research Program of the Water Mission Area at USGS. Boulder, Colorado. She received a BS in chemistry from Georgetown University and an MS and PhD in environmental engineering from the California Institute of Technology. She worked on bioremediation of uranium for her postdoctoral work at the USGS in Menlo Park, California, before joining the chemical modeling of acid waters group. Her research focuses on abiotic and biotic redox chemistry of natural waters, including acid rock, drainage, geothermal waters, and groundwaters. Biogeochemical modeling of kinetic controlled processes, especially iron, arsenic, antimony, and uranium redox chemistry, coupled biotic, abiotic controls on microbial ecology and geothermal and mining environments, and novel sampling techniques for redox processes for field application. Our second speaker, Dr. Brian Hadley, is a senior photogrammetrist. With a geospatial section of the BLM's National Operations Center in Denver, Colorado. He received a BA and MA in geography from the University of California and a PhD in geography remote sensing from the University of South Carolina. Before coming to the Bureau in 2013, Brian worked as a GIS manager for the South Carolina Army National Guard in Columbia, South Carolina, and as a remote sensing analyst at NOAA's National Ocean Service Office for Coastal Management. Brian's work at BLM is primarily focused on the use of traditional aerial and close-range photogrammetry for the mapping and monitoring of natural resources. The BLM geospatial section provides remote sensing, photogrammetry, and UAS operational services to BLM staff across all levels of the organization. And with that, we turn it to Kate.
Thank you so much, Rosalyn. First of all, I would really like to thank all of you on the line for taking time out of your busy day to participate in this webinar. I'd also like to thank the organizers for putting together this truly fantastic set of webinar series, and it's truly an honor to be asked to be participating in this today. So today, I will be giving a talk, a very broad overview talk, about some of the work that we do at the USGS relating to mine sites, and specifically, how understanding fundamental biogeochemical processes can help improve geochemical modeling. And our ultimate goal is to help provide tools that can be used to optimize remediation approaches at mine sites. All right, so you may see a poll pop up. This is just to get a sense of how many of you on the line are actually involved in metal remediation or have been in the past. So I ask you take a few minutes and just respond on your level of involvement in remediation. And in the meantime, I'm going to talk through this slide, and at the end we'll share the results of that poll. So metal remediation strategies can be grouped into several broad categories. And the first is sort of a conventional water treatment or pump and treat for groundwater. Just getting the mouse to work. There we go. So this image that you see on the slide is actually a lime neutralization plant at the Iron Mountain Mine in California, and I'll be highlighting this in my third case study during this talk. But essentially, this is a lime treatment to neutralize acid mine drainage at the site and remove metals from solution. Now, these type of conventional water treatment facilities can be expensive, but they can also be very effective. A more passive type of approach that can be used for surface waters is constructed wetlands and also surface bioreactors. So these require a little bit less input, and they can be tailored to a particular site to mainly treat surface water in a more passive fashion. In addition, engineered covers can be used to manage mine waste, such as waste rock piles or tailings piles. For groundwater, a more passive approach could be an injection of some sort of reagent that stimulates a particular chemical or biological process in the subsurface. So in this picture, you can actually see a well field with an injection tank. So this is a type of in situ approach to treat groundwater. I'll particularly be talking in this presentation about reductive approaches, in particular uranium, to stimulate biological reduction of uranium using an organic carbon injection. But there are many different approaches, including different chemical amendments. So I will also talk about phosphate injections that can be used for mineral precipitation. And although we won't be touching on permeable reactive barriers in this presentation, permeable reactive barriers can also be implemented to treat shallow groundwater systems.
So, Kate, could we take a look back at your poll question
and yes, just get a
great.
Thank you.
So you had asked how many people worked on a site or project that implemented a treatment for metals, and it looks like almost half of them are currently working on such a project. About a third of the audience has previously worked on a project, but they're not working on one right now, and then the rest, about 16%, are saying no, but they're interested. And a few people were, I think, honest and said, no, I'm just here to hear about the drones. So thanks so much for participating, everyone.
Yeah, thanks. That's really interesting. We have a really diverse group of people on the phone, and I appreciate the wide variety of knowledge base that I'm sure is out there. So when we talk about mental mobility, really what we want to understand are what are the reactions that are controlling whether metals are going to be sequestered in a solid phase or mobilized into the aqueous phase. And so we're truly trying to identify a key set of reactions that describe the important processes at a particular site. And so it's really the intersection of several geochemical parameters. The first, of course, is pH, one of the fundamental controlling aspects of all geochemistry. And then superimposed on that are the presence of metal-binding ligands, whether these are organic or inorganic ligands that can really affect whether metals are going to be mobile into solution. And then finally, we also need to consider metal oxidation state. At the intersection of all of these processes, we can get a better understanding of whether mineral precipitation or dissolution will occur, and also metal adsorption onto solid phases. So again, the goal is to really characterize the set of chemical reactions that are important in the system. An important aspect of that is whether these reactions are at chemical equilibrium or at disequilibrium. So for example, metal binding ligands often react very quickly, and so in many cases we can assume that those reactions are in fact at chemical equilibrium. However, when we deal with redox, metal oxidation states, we often find ourselves working in the realm of disequilibrium. Now this actually provides an interesting opportunity for looking for biotic processes. Essentially, bacteria can utilize chemical disequilibrium for their own growth processes. In addition, disequilibrium is the point at which kinetics of reactions can become important. And so just a quick example of this. At low pH, so pH is less than about 4 or so, iron 2 in solution, even in the presence of dissolved oxygen, even though it's thermodynamically favorable to be oxidized to iron 3, is often kinetically limited. So we can often find iron 2 in solution at low pH. However, there are a number of organisms that have evolved to take advantage of this disequilibrium, and they actually grow by oxidizing iron 2 in the presence of oxygen to iron 3. Now, once iron 3 is present in solution, we can see a series of different precipitation reactions occur as well. So this is just one example of a common mineral called schwartzmannite that's found in acid mine systems. Iron 3 just reacts and precipitates into schwartzmannite. This can also be a kinetically driven process. Because mining and remediation often perturbs the redox state of a system, it's really important to consider metal oxidation state and whether these disequilibrium reactions are present in your system. So that's sort of the focus of the work that I'm going to be presenting today. And the reason we want to understand these fundamental biogeochemical processes is because we can improve our geochemical modeling capabilities. So the first step is to identify the key reactions. Then we have to identify whether or not we can represent those reactions as equilibrium or whether we need to include reaction kinetics. So for example, microbial processes, I've already mentioned this in the previous slide, but bacteria undergo a life cycle, and that can be represented by this plot. This is cells per mil as a function of time. This is sort of a generic cartoon of a microbial growth cycle. And so cells tend to start off in a lag phase. They grow through exponential. They eventually hit what's called a stationary phase, where they stop growing. And they may even eventually hit a decline or death phase. And so at any point along this curve, the rate of reactions may actually change based on the metabolism of the cell. So microbial processes should be represented slightly differently in terms of a kinetic expression, just because of the nature of a cell being able to grow, reproduce, and die. So our approach to biogeochemical modeling is to start with a conceptual model. So in this case, we have identified our key reactions, our biogeochemical processes. We can combine that with the hydrology of the scenario. Then we start to build our quantitative model. In our quantitative model, this will incorporate both equilibrium and kinetic processes. And the examples that I'll show, I'm primarily using the code FreakC. This is a USGS a geochemical code, but there are a number of different codes out there. I'm sure many of you are familiar with geochemical modeling codes. And ultimately, the goal of creating a quantitative model is to use it as a management tool. So we are able to test remediation strategies and treatment designs. However, one thing that we've learned is that a quantitative model can be extremely important when we compare it against laboratory and field data. We can actually use the quantitative model to evaluate our conceptual model. Very often we find that there's a gap in our conceptual model when we try to model it. And so we can use it as sort of an iterative procedure to improve our conceptual model. And ultimately that will improve the quantitative model as a management tool. Our approach to our research is to work across a continuum of scales. So we start at the laboratory scale with fairly simple batch reactors, maybe pure bacterial cultures, synthetic water, or pure mineral phases. And the goal of that is to really understand the key processes that are at play in a particular system. Once we understand that, we can increase the complexity and maybe move to more complicated experiments in the laboratory, such as column experiments, using a mixed microbial community, natural sediments, for example. And we can even scale up further to a field-scale in situ experiment. And I'll discuss a little bit more about these in situ experiments in my first case study. But these sort of middle range of the continuum are really important to help us understand and quantify the rates of these key processes. And then ultimately, we want to scale up to full scale or pilot scale and full scale treatment and remediation regimes. And really at the field scale, we'll also have to incorporate heterogeneity and the complexity of working on a larger scale. So next I'll talk about three different case studies that highlight different aspects of this approach. The first case study is looking at the bioremediation of a uranium-contaminated aquifer. The second case study is removal of dissolved uranium and surface passivation of uranium ore with a phosphate amendment. And then the third case study is acid mine drainage and pipeline scaling. So without further ado, the first case study is bioremediation at a site in Rifle, Colorado. Now this is a site that historically had been used as a uranium mill tailings or mill processing facility and had extensive tailings on the site. This site's pretty typical of a number of legacy sites across the Intermountain West. So the tailings were removed, but the groundwater still exceeds the target concentrations for uranium. So this particular site became an intensive study funded by the DOE to look specifically at the fundamental processes at play during bioremediation and how to tailor this to be an effective treatment strategy for other uranium-contaminated sites. So the whole idea behind this type of bioremediation is to reduce uranium-6 to uranium-4. And uranium-4 is relatively immobile. And so we do this by amending the groundwater with organic carbon. So this could be a natural organic matter. In our case, we're using acetate, but essentially it's an energy source for bacteria represented by these orange oblongs. And so uranium-6 gets reduced to uranium-4, and uranium-4 is very insoluble. And so in this case, I'm showing precipitation of biogenic uraninite. Bacteria, when they're given an organic carbon source, they can also reduce iron-3 to iron-2. And as the bacteria produce iron-2, iron-2 can react abiotically with uranium-6 as well, producing different forms of uranium-4. Either way, by adding organic carbon, we stimulate a microbial community and reduce uranium-6 to relatively immobile uranium-4, which is the goal of the process. So at Rifle, essentially what we did is we pulled groundwater from an upgradient background well. We amended it with acetate, again, a really rich carbon source for bacteria. We injected it into the subsurface and monitored what happened down gradient. And essentially what we found, there were zones of iron and uranium reduction. And in more reducing conditions, we found sulfate reduction. So let's look at some of the data from these experiments. This plot here shows the acetate. So as acetate's being injected into the subsurface, it starts to be consumed. And in fact, by 70 days, it's completely consumed. So acetate's still being injected, but it's being completely consumed by the microbial community. We see uranium concentrations decrease. So uranium reduction is occurring. We also see iron 2 increasing. And then at later times, we see strong sulfate reduction. At the same time, we also see decreases in iron 2, probably because iron 2 sulfides are being precipitated. Now, during sulfate reduction, all of the acetate is being consumed, and we do start to see a slight rebound in uranium concentrations during that time. So we also looked at the microbial community during this experiment. And so the upgradient control wells, so these are wells that have never seen acetate, you can see they have a fairly diverse microbial community. This is looking at the 16S DNA of all the organisms that are present in the groundwater. I've highlighted in particular in green the sulfate-reducing bacteria, and in yellow, Geobacter, which is a metal-reducing bacteria that is known to both reduce uranium and iron. So as soon as acetate is injected, we see that the Geobacter bloom. And this corresponds to the time period where we see uranium decreasing in solution. But as time goes on in the experiment, we notice that the proportion of Geobacter decreases, the amount of sulfate-reducing bacteria increase. And so the population is essentially shifting from metal-reducing organisms to sulfate-reducing organisms. Now, this is just a simplistic snapshot. There's actually been extensive work done on understanding the microbial community during bioremediation. And that work has shown that there are a number of different redox cycles active during bioremediation. So carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, iron, arsenic, uranium, vanadium, just to name a few of the elements that are actively being metabolized by the microbes. In addition, there's evidence that predators, such as protists, start to flourish during bioremediation. And there's also a bloom of viruses that can happen as well. So the actual controls in the microbial community are quite diverse, and it's a very complex system. So while we were running this biostimulation experiment, we were drilling some wells, and we came across some zones of naturally reduced sediments. So this is essentially subsurface heterogeneity that we wanted to explore further. So in these zones of natural bioreduction, we actually saw natural organic matter that was deposited in the alluvial aquifer originally, and slowly over a period of at least 80 years, uranium, iron, and sulfur were naturally bioreduced in these lenses in the aquifer. And so it was a very good analog, a natural analog, to what we were trying to do in the biostimulation experiment. What was also interesting is the uranium-4 in these zones of naturally bioreduced sediments was actually quite resistant to reoxidation, even when there was significant amounts of dissolved oxygen in the subsurface environment. So we used this as an opportunity to investigate the subsurface heterogeneity and look at the naturally bioreduced sediments as an effective analog for our biostimulation experiments. And this brings us to an important aspect, which is the stability of uranium-4 phases. So this particular aquifer tends to experience seasonal changes, and pulses of dissolved oxygen are quite common. So this is an aquifer that may want to be suboxic or even oxic at different times of year. So the question is, once we've reduced uranium-6 to uranium-4, how stable is that uranium-4 to reoxidation? So we ran a series of in situ experiments. So these are basically tubes and columns that we were able to placed into a well in the subsurface during a biostimulation experiment, and then also after the experiment to look at the rates of oxidation of uranium-4. So essentially, we placed a known amount of biogenic uraninite into the subsurface, removed tubes at different times, and were able to measure the rates of oxidation. So not only were we able to actually get a quantitative rate that we could then apply to the modeling, but we also identified that biomass and other surface reactions, such as the adsorption of calcium, can actually retard oxidative dissolution. So these rates were a little bit slower than what we expected based on laboratory experiments. So these types of intermediate experiments can be really helpful in actually getting quantitative rate information. And that, in turn, was incorporated into the larger geochemical models for the site. All right, so next I'm going to move on to our second case study, which is phosphate amendment for in situ recovery uranium mines. So ISR mines are interesting because this is a very extreme perturbation of the redox conditions of a subsurface environment. So in this case, during active mining, the target is a uranium-4 ore zone. This is showing a roll front deposit, which is fairly common in the western United States. The input is essentially groundwater that's been amended with dissolved oxygen and bicarbonate. Bicarbonate is essentially a complexing agent for uranium-6. So this oxygen serves as an oxidant. It oxidizes the uranium-4, producing uranium-6, which is then pumped out of the ground, and the uranium-6 is recovered using ion exchange. So this is a solution extraction technique. It doesn't require the types of waste rock and overburden that you often see in conventional mining, but it does perturb the subsurface environment. So the question is, what happens after mining has ceased? And so what we found is that extraction efficiency is anywhere from 60 to 80%, and that there's some residual uranium-4 ore material remaining even after mining. Now, because the groundwater is now oxic, there's sort of this slow release of uranium-6 as those relic uranium-4 ore material is slowly oxidized. And as a result, we can have elevated concentrations of uranium-6 in the groundwater. So one potential remediation option is to amend the groundwater with phosphate. And the reason for doing this is phosphate can react with the calcium in the groundwater as well as the dissolved uranium-6 and precipitate. We know that the calcium uranium phosphate phases are quite insoluble. The uranium can be removed by two different methods. The first is by actually adsorption onto a calcium phosphate phase, such as hydroxyapatite. And the second is direct precipitation of a calcium uranyl phosphate phase, such as autunite. So after some initial experiments, we've noticed that the presence of phosphate can actually retard the oxidative dissolution of the relic uranium-4 ore. So our hypothesis is actually that passivation is occurring. And essentially, passivation is a presence of a coating of these calcium phosphate phases around the ore that essentially retards the rate of oxidation. So it affects the oxidation kinetics. And this is a key process that we need to understand better in order to incorporate into our models. So these are some experiments that a student of mine is currently working on, Tyler Kane. And we're starting with a very simple approach of doing a controlled set of laboratory experiments to test the hypothesis that passivation can retard uranium-4 oxidation. So he ran a series of experiments where he took biogenic uraninite, mixed it in an artificial groundwater in a bottle in the laboratory, and amended that with phosphate in the presence of uranium-6 in solution as well. He aged the solution and found that calcium, uranium-6, and phosphate indeed precipitated out. Then he washed the solids, so he essentially removed the phosphate from solution and replaced the water with an artificial groundwater that didn't have any phosphate. So the purpose of this third step is to measure the rate of dissolution and oxidation of the remaining solids. So essentially the stability of the precipitates created in this experiment. So we look at the solution chemistry. I'll walk you through this plot. We're looking at concentrations of calcium in the top plot, phosphorus in the middle plot, and uranium in the lower plot. In green, we have a control experiment. So the control was essentially the artificial groundwater with uraninite, but no phosphate added. And you can see that uraninite oxidizes quite rapidly and approaches equilibrium within less than a month. However, in the presence of phosphate, we see calcium being removed from solution. We can see phosphate being removed from solution. And also, uranium goes below detection limit for our analytical method very rapidly. We performed this under both anoxic and oxic conditions and found that the behavior was very, very similar. At this point, with the dashed line, this is where Tyler washed the solids and replaced an artificial groundwater solution that didn't have any phosphate present. So we're looking at how stable those uranyl calcium phosphate solid phases are. And what we see is that we see no rebounding of phosphate or calcium and very little uranium mobilized into solution. So we're seeing very slow dissolution kinetics, and the precipitates basically sequester all the uranium in the solid phase. We look at the solids, we see particles that look like this under SEM, or scanning electron microscopy. So inside this particle is a uraninite that's been completely surrounded by a calcium phosphate uranium-containing phase. And it turns out this phase is hydroxyapatite. And uraninite can be found long after complete oxidation was observed in the control bottles. And even when the uraninite eventually oxidizes, the uranium still remains associated with all of the solids. So this is really good evidence that, in fact, passivation is a mechanism that we need to consider and could be really advantageous when considering a phosphate amendment as a remediation strategy. So currently, Tyler's working on testing this particular scenario with actual ore material from an ISR site using some column studies. So we'll get a better sense of the rates at which the passivation may affect oxidative dissolution of the ore. All right, so just a really quick summary of the first two case studies. So we started with bioremediation. So we're trying to create reducing conditions, and it can be effective as long as reducing conditions can be maintained. We saw this incredible complexity of microbial community dynamics. And this particular project was able to successfully incorporate the complexity of the biogeochemistry into the reactive transport models that were developed for the site. The second case study was phosphate amendment, which can be effective under both oxidizing and reducing conditions. Passivation of uranium-4 surfaces may retard oxidation, so this affects the kinetics of oxidative dissolution. And what we'd really like to explore or how to combine bioremediation with phosphate amendments, because this could be a great way to help stabilize uranium in the subsurface by combining these different approaches. And we can see that this might have applications to a number of different sites. So obviously in situ mines, but also conventional mines and legacy sites. So at this point in the talk, I'll turn it back over to the moderators. Are there any burning questions about the first two case studies before I move on to the third?
Yeah, so Kate, there were a couple questions that came in while you were presenting, people wanting to know more specifics about some of the things you were talking about. So sure, we can ask a couple of those now. We had a questioner who was wondering if the bacteria are reoxidizing the uranium to reduce the sulfate.
That's a great question. I don't know that we specifically looked for that process. However, there's such a diversity of metabolisms that, in fact, I would I would hypothesize that that could be at an active, something, that, a metabolism that could be active at the site.
Okay, and then another question was about the passivation with phosphate, and they're wondering if, you know, how it would work on surface uranium waste rock or tailings, and then also how often would the phosphate need to be reapplied in the arid west was the specific question.
Those are great questions. I think at the stage of the research where we're at, because we're doing such controlled laboratory experiments, we don't have answers to that yet. However, I can see this research growing as we start to expand to you know, actual ores. We can test in a more arid type of column study, so not assuming necessarily saturated conditions, but more something that would be maybe more applicable for like a waste rock pile or a tailings pile. I think these are all great applications now that we've sort of identified that passivation might be an additional process that we should consider. Optimizing phosphate amendment, I think, should be done.
All right. Thanks, Kate. We did get one more question we'll ask you right now. What are the potential consequences of increased predator bacteria and viruses during the bioremediation?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. I don't think it's necessarily like a health hazard. It's sort of more of microbial community dynamics that, of course, when you start to just increase the biomass by amending the subsurface with a great organic carbon source such as acetate, that the natural dynamics take over and we start seeing more predators and viruses. And so the viruses are not necessarily what would affect a human, but can actually control the microbial community. So I guess the real take-home message is microbial communities are very complex. They're hard to control, and they may undergo many different kinds of life cycles that affect metal mobility.
Okay.
Great.
I think that's good for now, Kate. We'll keep looking at the questions and get some more of them as you wrap up.
Sounds good. All right, so I'm going to move on to the third case study, which is focusing on acid mine drainage. So this particular case study, we're shifting gears just a little bit, but I wanted to highlight this because it kind of shows the whole range of understanding processes in a laboratory all the way up to a field scale and then actually implementing some remediation strategies. So we're going to focus on two different mines, Iron Mountain Mine, which is in the northern part of California. And this is a massive sulfide deposit that was mined for about 100 years, mainly for copper, silver, and gold. It's been on the national priority list since 1983. A Leviathan mine is a sulfur deposit. There's a little bit of copper there as well. And this was also mined periodically for about 100 years before the cleanup began in the 1980s. This is also a CERCLA site, I think as of around 2000. Now, both of these sites have treatment plants for acid mine drainage. And in order to convey the acid mine drainage to those treatment plants, they have a system of pipelines. And in both cases, we see a phenomenon called pipe scaling. And that's the accumulation of this iron-rich precipitate inside the pipeline. And this is actually a very common phenomenon in conveyances for acid mine drainage. Now, at Iron Mountain, it requires a costly cleanout about every 2 to 4 years of their pipelines. And at Leviathan Mine, many of the pipes are simply replaced every year because of the scaling issue. So we were asked to investigate what causes the scaling, what its composition was, and what could be done about it. So this is an overview of the Iron Mountain Mine by satellite. Here is the open pit. There are underground workings throughout this entire area. And so as a result, there are two different pipelines carrying water from the area where it's draining down to the water treatment plant. This is the picture that I showed on the second slide of my talk. So in green, we have the Richmond pipeline. And the Richmond pipeline is interesting because it doesn't actually exhibit scaling, and that's primarily because the pH of the water is very low. It's typically between 0.5 and 1, even though it has high concentrations of iron and sulfate. Now, in contrast, the PW3 pipeline, which is shown here in red, so PW3 is essentially a station where they pump water from the underground workings into the pipeline. PW3, you can see the pH is a little bit higher. It's about pH 2.5 to 3. In the pie charts here, I'm showing in blue the fraction of iron 2 compared to iron 3 in red, and then the total iron is shown in this number beneath the chart. So you can see it's primarily iron 2 in the PW3. And as we go down the pipeline, we can actually see the fraction of iron 3 increases. So iron is being oxidized from iron 2 to iron 3 in situ. Also, the total iron decreases down the length of the pipeline. And so really, we're able to observe in the pipeline itself iron oxidation and precipitation occurring. And this is pretty remarkable considering that the transit time from PW3 to, say, the service saddle, the point where we sampled, SS2, is on the order of half an hour to 45 minutes. So this is very rapid, and we're actually able to see precipitation occurring in the pipeline. So at this point, we brought some water back from both the Iron Mountain Mine and Leviathan Mines. We took unfiltered water, we shipped it back to the laboratory within 24 hours, started these laboratory experiments. So essentially, we took the unfiltered water, we ran some batch experiments with the water only to look at biotic iron 2 oxidation. We combined that with a little bit of scale to measure the effect of scale. We also filtered the water through a 0.1 micron filter, which essentially removed all of the microbial components. So we're just looking at abiotic iron 2 oxidation in the control. And what we found, so this is a plot of iron 2 as a function of time in the batch experiments. And our abiotic controls showed no evidence of iron 2 oxidation. So it all stayed as iron 2. However, in the unfiltered water, and the unfiltered water with scale, we see rapid iron 2 oxidation, so iron 2 decreases as it's being oxidized to iron 3, and precipitation. And you can actually see the presence of scale changes the rate of iron oxidation. So we know from these experiments that iron 2 oxidation is a biotic process in this system. In addition, we collected scale samples. This is just a schematic to show the types of characterization that we can apply to these systems to get a really detailed sense of what's happening. So for example, we characterized the mineralogy using X-ray diffraction and scanning electron microscopy. We also did a series of wet chemical extractions, again, to get at trace metal concentrations and also mineralogy, total elemental digestions, carbon and nitrogen analysis, which at low pHs can be very indicative of biomass concentrations. And we also took a look at the microbial community using 16S DNA, so culture independent, but also some culturing methods where we use most probable number techniques to look at specifically iron oxidizing bacteria. I won't go through all of the details of our characterization, but I did want to highlight just a couple of results. The first is that we identified the bulk mineralogy is similar in all of the scale, and it's primarily schwartmannite with a minor amount of goethite. And we can actually quantify that by spiking our sample with an internal standard of corundum, and then using our techniques to quantify the amount of schwartmannite and goethite. And you can see that is between 96 and 99% schwartmannite. And when we look at the samples under scanning electron microscopy, we can see these beautiful pincushion morphologies that are very indicative of schwartmannite morphology. So the next step was to work on developing a geochemical model. So again, we used FreakC to model our batch reactions. So in blue, we have our experimental data. In red, we have our model data. And you can see iron 2 as a function of time. And we modeled this using microbial kinetics. So again, because we know this is a microbial process, we used an enzyme kinetics type of expression to model iron 2 oxidation. In addition, when we look at total iron, we can see precipitation occurring, and this is also a kinetically controlled process. So we had to add kinetics for Schwartzmannite precipitation. But when we do this, we get a fairly good representation of what happens with pH, which is a good indicator that we have a fairly strong conceptual model and a fairly strong numerical model for the batch experiments. So the next step was to scale this up to actually modeling what was happening within the pipeline. So what we did, we went to the field, we did a slug-style injection. Our conservative tracer was lithium, which is great for acidic conditions. And you can see here's lithium as a function of time at the different service saddles or portals into the pipeline. And from this data, we were able to identify travel times and dispersivity under several different flow regimes. And we actually had to implement a variable velocity in each section of the pipeline. So the next step was to combine the tracer and the physical characteristics that we measured with the tracer with our geochemical model from the batch experiments. And so when we did that, we were able to create a model that we started to test different remediation strategies for the site. In this case, our first remediation trial was whether we could increase the flow within the pipeline to prevent a scale from forming. So we ran simulations looking at iron oxidation, so this is the percent iron 2 at different service saddles, so essentially as the water moves downstream in the pipeline, to look at how much we would have to increase the flow to substantially decrease the rate of iron oxidation. And we can see from both the model simulations and even a test of this in the field using actual water in the pipeline that doubling the flow only slightly decreased the amount oxidized. And even running at the highest flow rate, scale will still form in the pipeline. But the take-home message is that the model can be used to simulate the effect of running the pipeline at different flow rates to test whether or not this is a reasonable strategy, and also to test what the effect might be on treatment plant operations. So our second set of tests was, instead of changing the operation of the pipeline, was to actually mix PW3 with a lower pH water. And if you recall, the Richmond pipeline has extremely low pH water. So at this particular site, there's actually a built-in mechanism for decreasing the pH. So with this test, we basically ran our model. We found that mixing PW3 with about 5% of the low pH Richmond water should be sufficient to decrease the pH and prevent Schwartzmannite from precipitating. So we then ran a series of batch experiments in the lab to verify this. And what you can see here, I'm not sure where the pointer went, but if you look at the top plot, oh, there it is. All right, thank you. This is a series of batch experiments we ran with no scale present, so just PW3 water mixed with Richmond water. And when 1% Richmond water was mixed, we see a decrease in the total iron, suggesting that iron is precipitating. However, once we hit the 5% or the 10% mark, we no longer see precipitation. So this essentially verifies our hypothesis and our model. Now, if scale is present in the pipeline, so we wanted to simulate what would happen if the scale had not been removed and we mixed it with Richmond water, what would happen? And essentially what we see, I'll direct your attention to the lower plot, which is showing pH as a function of time. And you can see that the scale actually strongly buffers the pH to about 2.1 to 2.2. So if there's no scale in the pipeline, mixing with a lower pH water, in fact, can be very effective at retarding the precipitation of Schwartzmannite. However, if scale is present, it actually has a strong buffering capacity that sort of overcomes the addition of the Richmond water. So just to summarize in a broader perspective, sort of the message I'd like you to take away from this talk, and that's understanding fundamental biogeochemical processes can improve conceptual and numerical models. And the idea is not to make our model so complex it could never be applied. Quite the opposite. We actually want to balance the complexity with broad applicability by identifying these key reactions. Hopefully these case studies have demonstrated that there are strong links between the microbiology, the mineralogy, the hydrology, and the water chemistry. And working on integrating all of these aspects can really improve the models and actually is necessary to consider site management from a holistic perspective. And hopefully these case studies can illustrate different options when it comes to treatment approaches and how we bridge laboratory data all the way up to field scale processes and how we link model development and improvement by using strong sets of laboratory data. And so with that, I would definitely like to acknowledge everyone that has helped with this work. This is certainly not my work only. It's been a huge team of people that has produced this data, and I am very indebted to all of them. So with that, I will turn it back over to the moderators. I'll take any questions you may have.
All right.
Great. Thanks, Kate. We are getting some questions coming in. I'm going to encourage all of our participants to keep submitting questions as we're reading through what's come in already, and we'll try to do our best to get to all of them. We have a questioner here that wants to know if you've had any experience with bioremediation of selenium.
I don't have direct experience with selenium. However, that is a great example of a redox active element that could benefit from a bioremediation. And I know there's a lot of work that's been done on selenium.
Okay.
So you feel free to reach out to me, and I can help maybe guide towards some of that literature if you're interested.
Cool. And you'll see the participants can see Kate's email address on the slide that's being presented right now, and her contact information is also included on our main seminar page. We're getting a few questions about the modeling with FREAK. One of the questions is that how you did you do all of your modeling with that program?
I have, but certainly it's not the only program that can be very effective. I know there are a bunch of different codes out there that can be used. Also, there are ways to couple, say, FREAK-C, which is only goes up to a one-dimensional reactive transport model. Working in a pipeline, it's actually really ideal because it actually is essentially a one-dimensional reactive transport problem. But you can couple FREAK-C to, say, like mod flow through PHT3D. There are a bunch of different options that you can use to couple the reactive part of the reactive transport model to or groundwater flow models to scale it up.
Okay, thank you. And another question related to the modeling, can you talk about your use of the model and any comparison with your actual data observations?
Yes. So our model, because we included all of these fundamental processes that we investigated in the laboratory, so by that I mean, say, the microbial kinetics and precipitation kinetics, which required a lot of data, but it definitely helped us to hone in on what's important. And by including more of those processes, I think we're actually able to apply the model more broadly, say, to other sites, at Leviathan, for example, and I'd love to test this out at other sites as well. So the idea was really to do an intensive study at Iron Mountain to develop a model protocol that could be more transferable to other sites.
Okay, great, because that leads into the next question that we received, and this person would like to know if the process that you're using would work for pit lake remediation.
Ah, interesting. I haven't directly applied this to pit lakes. However, a lot of the processes that I mentioned in here are absolutely active in pit lakes. And so all of this fundamental work, I think, gives great insight into, say, how one might modify a treatment for a pit lake and tailor it for a particular site as well. So, yes, I think it has value.
Okay, cool. So here's an interesting question that came in. This person would like to know if you know if it's true that Schwarzmanite has been found on Mars, and if so, does that imply anything about microbial formation of the mineral?
That's a very interesting question. So there's been a lot of interest, especially at Iron Mountain, looking at especially the Gossan at the site, but also just the general processes that are happening as a Mars analog. And so I would say there's nothing conclusive that would say Schwarzmanite can only form under biotic conditions, but that's definitely an active line of research because these extreme environments, such as Iron Mountain, are great analogs for exobiology. So unfortunately, there's no conclusive answer, but it's definitely a great question and a great line of research.
Yeah, and a very interesting comparison. The one last thing I'm going to ask you right now, Kate, the people are interested in some of the papers that you've been citing on your slides and were wondering where they might get a list of those references.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can provide a list of references that maybe you can post after the talk.
That's great.
Feel free to reach out to me directly. But, yeah, I'll compile that list of references, and I'll make it available to everybody.
Excellent, because we do have a resource seminar resources section, and we can include that for future reference for everyone.
Great. I'll absolutely do that.
Great. And I just want to say thank you for your presentation and answering all the questions, and we did receive a number of thank yous from the participants also. So thank you for a job well done, Kate.
Great. Thank you very much.
And now I think we're ready to move on to our second presentation. I think Jean is pulling up the slides now. So with that, I think we can move on to Brian Hadley.
Okay. I think I'm unmuted. Can everybody hear me?
Yes. You sound wonderful.
Thank you. All right. So first let me say thanks to Kate. I thought that was a fantastic presentation. Certainly different than the stuff that we do at our agency, the Bureau of Land Management. And I also want to thank three ladies, Jean, Michelle, and Rosalind. They are fantastic, and organizing all this stuff is a lot of work, and they do a terrific job. So thank you to them as well. I am going to talk a broad overview about the BLM's unmanned aircraft systems program. This presentation, I believe, was originally given at a conference by my colleague Jason Frelts, who is actively involved in our Abandoned Mines program. And Jason asked me to take this presentation and add some additional information about mining activities and volumetric measurements that we make with our UAS equipment. And so I am going to give you guys, as I said, an overview of the BLM program, our aircraft, and a handful of applications that we use the aircraft and our camera systems for, and then we'll look at a couple of specific cases as it relates to mining activities and the calculation of volumetric measurements that we use for production verification. So the BLM Aviation Program is housed out of the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho. It is a part or under the guidance of the Department of Interior's Office of Aviation Services. We refer that to OAS, and OAS is the ones that are ultimately in charge of all of the BLM and the other Department of Interior agencies that operate UAS aircraft. The BLM's National Aviation Plan, I have it written there, and I believe Gene's going to provide you guys with a link to it. The Aviation Plan is available to look at. It's a comprehensive plan of all of the aviation activities, including manned aircraft and the unmanned systems that our office operates here. a significant amount of coordination occurs between the UAS operations here and in the other DOI agencies, as I said, with the Office of Aircraft Services. They are the ones that ultimately make the decisions on what aircraft you can fly, what payloads you can load onto those aircraft. We check in constantly during flight activities, and some of those things have changed with the FAA rules that govern the operation. OPM 1311 is our documented procedures for the use of UAS, and there's also a DOI FAA memorandum that says where we can fly and when we can fly. The BLM's aviation program is obviously highly focused on safety. That includes, again, manned and unmanned aircraft, aviation dispatch, and the equipment is used from everything to support wildfire activities, which is the primary use of manned aircraft in the BLM, to gathering wild horse and burrow, habitat monitoring, cadastral survey. Law enforcement officials typically use aircraft for situational awareness type activities, and then my group is obviously heavily involved in aerial mapping, range surveys, and biological surveys and things like that from the natural resource standpoint. So we were saying for a long time that drones are coming. Get ready, drones are coming. Well, drones are here, and they are becoming a commonplace within BLM. As little as 2 years ago, the BLM operated about 5 aircraft, and those were all manned aircraft. By the end of the fiscal year, we figure to have 100. That is a unique distinction because UASs are treated the same way the manned aircraft are, which has a combination of problems. We would like to get to the point where the equipment is treated just like any other field equipment. You take it out and you use it just like you would a GPS or any other type of a field equipment. As I mentioned, coordination and policy is set by the Office of Aircraft Services, and the BLM National Aviation Office is largely the other partner for aviation. We are working towards a model where the BLM National Operations Center, where I work in Denver, will be primarily responsible for data management and data processing activities. That's what our photogrammetric shop does here. But we still do operate regularly. We've done about 15 projects so far this year with just a couple of our pilots. Training involves about 5 classes, and those are usually about a week long. It's how to operate the aircraft safely, all the regulations that go along with that, and actually operating, learning the equipment. And then we have some data processing classes, which right now about 1 to 2 classes, which we're going to continue to ramp up. Standards, metadata, workflows, and reporting, it's all a very important part of doing things the right way. Privacy is a huge issue. I know it is the primary issue for EPA. As I understand, the EPA does not operate any unmanned aircraft systems because of privacy. And then the other thing that is kind of a white elephant in the room for us is the IT requirements. Data storage, processing, visualization, automation, all of those things are all part of the downstream process after you collect the data. Projects can hit 500 gigabytes of data with thousands of images very easily, and for a small shop like ours, we are on an exponential curve for collecting data. Our program objectives start with safety. It's we cannot have a failure that results in damage to property, damage to other individuals, loss of life cannot happen. And it would be the end of the program that's scrutinized anyways. We focus on timely and high-quality scientific data. That involves the collection and the delivery. We're very much geared towards meeting individual project missions and objectives. We're an operational agency, not research-oriented. So these are geared towards giving managers, natural resource managers, the ability to use the information we derive to make decisions about management and policy-related issues. We also try to be local, and that's the part about going to 5 aircraft to 100 aircraft. We're also going to probably have about 100 pilots trained up before the end of the year. We want to be local. We want to engage pilots in the local area rather than sending folks from a centralized location in Idaho or in Denver. So let me tell you a little bit about a couple of our aircraft. The BLM has been operating UAS equipment for, believe it or not, about 10 years now. And originally our equipment came as hand-me-downs from our colleagues in the military. And you can see two of our primary aircraft here. The RQ-11A Raven is on your upper right screen. It is a hand-launched small UAS. It's a pusher aircraft. The prop's behind the wing there. It's painted up for visualization purposes. It's different than how the military would operate it. It has a flight duration of about an hour and 20 minutes, and it carries two camera systems in this nose cone here, and you can actually kind of see what looks like the lens here where I'm pointing. That carries a what we call an EO sensor. It's really a natural color camera and a thermal infrared sensor. The other one that we have is used to have is what's called the Honeywell RQ-16 T-Hawk. It got the nickname as the flying trash can or the flying mini Weber barbecue. It's really what it looks like. It's a deducted fan system. Inside of this disc here in the center of it is a large fan, and it has rotors down here that drive the direction. Believe it or not, this thing can fly about 80 miles an hour. It has two cameras here in a gimbaled pod. It's also a EO system and a thermal infrared system. And it's a gasoline-operated thing, very loud. And neither of these pieces of equipment are things that we currently use. We crashed all the Ravens, and they are no parts left for them. It is obsolete now by the military, and so we're not going to be using those anymore. And we've moved on to other aircraft that are more appropriate for our needs. One of the things I'd point out to you guys, look at this table here, and look at all of the equipment. You can see the T-Hawk sitting here next to my colleague Lance Brady. The gas cans, all the things that you need to operate that stuff, it is an intensive process. Moving on to our newer equipment, Falcon Unmanned Fixed Wing is a 60-minute duration fixed wing aircraft. It's got about a 2-pound payload, so it'll carry a small camera. And our primary piece of equipment now is the 3DR Solo. And you can see the picture that I've put here where the green arrow is. Comparing that to the equipment that we had on the last slide, this is it. It's got backpack straps on the case. Guys, and grab the iPod, grab the controls, grab the unit, and grab the cameras, and you're good to go. That's a 20-minute flight duration, and it'll handle a little less than a pound for its payload, which is perfectly fine for a small compact camera. So we have a very deliberate process that we go through to do a UAS project that applies to all of BLM, so partners in Boise as well. And it starts with a project request, and the appropriate aviation managers take a look at that and determine whether or not it is something that would be allowed to be flown in the airspace. We follow that up with looking at the appropriateness of the UAS platform. We get a lot of requests for UAS data for tens of thousands of acres of land. That is not something that the UAS equipment is appropriate for. It would result in tens of thousands of photos, very long processing times. And so ultimately, we would say no. We need to look at that at a traditional remote sensing project. BLM approval, again, involves the unit and the state aviation managers, a line office, the National Aviation Office. If any of those folks object to the project, it's dead and we have to look at another thing. FAA approval, Part 107 is the new agreements. It's the rules for non-hobbyists, the small UAS operators, and it covers the broad spectrum of commercial uses for drones. weighing less than 55 pounds. All of our pilots now get FAA Part 107 approval, and that's what most all now operators have gone to. MOA is Memorandum of Agreement is the preferred method to determine where we can fly. If not, we need to have what's called a Certificate of Authorization that allows for flying. Project planning, it's Project Aviation Safety Plan. It's a PASP. It's what we talked about. The number one priority is safety. Public affairs is a big thing. We always announce to the public where we're going to be flying, when we're going to be flying, engage the public, so it's not perceived as a reconnaissance activities. We're not spying. We're looking at public lands for natural resource management, data collection, logistics, and scheduling, and BLM aviation dispatch coordination is all handled under the project planning. Flight operations involve a daily go, no-go decision. If the weather isn't appropriate, for whatever reason, those kinds of things come up, we suspend the flight operations and we look at the next day. And then I touched a minute ago on the challenges logistically and capacity-wise with data processing and management. The photogrammetric processing of the data that we collect, or the remote sensing processing, is part of the process to get to an end product. Image analysis, data publication, all the standards for metadata to follow through with our requirements for FGDC and standards for record keeping is all part of the data management activities. So we've worked on a lot of things here to try to streamline those processes. As I said, we have projects going almost constantly now with UAS activities. It involves the creation of very specific file naming conventions that we can use to keep us in line with what the data standard requirements are, and we have a whole bunch of metadata automation. So metadata needs to be very detailed. What was the process done on all the data that was collected? What type of camera, dates, all of those kinds of things are all part of the metadata standards. And we have templates and automated tools that fill that information out. And our colleagues at USGS Aeros Data Center in Sioux Falls have a very nice system. Their Earth Explorer system is a data dissemination tool that allows you to do a search on an area. You can do by coordinates. It is it's also accessible by names. It's got a very nice gazetteer function to it. You put in dates and your location, and it returns information. Eventually, all of our UAS data that we collect will be stored at Aeros Data Center and disseminated via Earth Explorer. And it's, as I said, we are rapidly increasing our data holdings here. And so that's going to be a nice resource available to folks to be able to access the data. There'll be a combination of both derived products and the original products. So if folks want to do their own analysis on the data, they'll have that option. Sort of lastly, when we talk about policy, there's a group of us here collaborate with the National Aviation Office for BLM. We want to stress to our colleagues in the field, we need you to ask why before we start a mission. Before we fly, ask why. And that really starts with the red bullet up here at the top. Why are you collecting the data, and what is the scientific and the management purpose that you are collecting the data for? And then we run through a series of these other questions to determine whether or not UAS technology and our staff members and our capacity and our equipment is the appropriate things to do that. And that involves what is the size of the object, the area, the phenomenon you want to identify. How large is the area you want to image? Do you need continuous coverage, or would sampling of imagery across the area suffice? Does the object you want to map or identify move? How frequently that does? Biological things, sage grouse, sandhill cranes, things that we've done like that, they do move, and that's a big challenge. Does the object you want to identify map have a unique characteristics to help it be observed? Seasonal phenology for plants is one. A lot of times we target maximum green, or maybe we want to see down to the ground, so we have the leaf-off conditions. What levels of precision and accuracy are required to meet your science and management decision? We can hit sub-centimeter levels of precision and accuracy with our equipment if we fly at the right altitude and the right cameras. It's a whole new game for remote sensing compared to what many of us are used to working satellite-based data. Do you need repeat measurements? Is there a temporal component to it, and how often does that temporal component come into play? Do you need to know where the object is in real-world space? Believe it or not, sometimes people don't. Relative is fine in some cases, but if you need to know your 3D coordinates, that requires a level of control. Do you need to know the height? Is that an important component? We can calculate height very well with photogrammetric methods. And do we already have relevant data? General categories of UAS projects. I have a breakdown here on the right side of your screen. And you can see this is a GoPro camera. Most of us are familiar with GoPros. GoPro cameras are really useful for full motion video, situational awareness type things. When we start talking about photogrammetric projects, we stay away from a GoPro camera because it has what's called a rolling shutter. And that's where it essentially acquires an image by going from the top of the sensor down to the bottom. That is very difficult when you have objects that are moving. You get what's called a rolling shutter effect. It's blur in the image. It's very hard from a photogrammetric standpoint to process that information. Here's a Ricoh GR. Is an excellent piece of camera equipment, about $600, and it's a really nice piece of camera equipment. You can get digital elevation models, 3D point count clouds, and orthomosaics, so high-quality 3D products. Down here at the bottom, this is what's called a Micasense Red Edge camera. It is a multispectral camera that gives you red, green, and blue, and near-infrared, and a red edge channel, and we use those types of things for spectral vegetation indices. There are now LiDAR instruments, hyperspectral instruments, there are radar instruments, thermal infrared instruments, and geophysical and air monitoring instruments that are also available but can be flown on pretty small UAS systems. I'm going to run through here some applications for you guys, and then, as I said, we'll touch on the mining stuff here at the end. Greater sage-grouse is a very big deal in the Department of Interior. Fish and Wildlife Service, BLM lands, is something that is a lot of federal dollars are going to, obviously, to map the locations and preserve the habitat for the sage-grouse. And we used, in collaboration with Colorado Parks and Wildlife and our colleagues at USGS, we went out and we did a survey. This is imagery on the lower right here. You're seeing this is thermal infrared imagery that was collected on a cool night. And the white little features here, those are your birds. And using a variety of what we call image-based classification and segmentation-type tools, object-based classifications, we're able to run through a suite of things and be able to identify features. And in this case, what you're seeing up here is you're seeing natural color imagery with the birds identified via the feature extraction software. And the females are clustered here and the males out on the periphery. And it was believed when compared against ground survey information for bird counts, we did a pretty good job of identifying the birds. And so looking at that as a operational thing moving forward. The HX Dam breach is a large earthen dam down in the Safford, Arizona area. You can see here is the dam after it It was breached. It was believed that it was caused by a about a 5.2 category magnitude earthquake in June of 2014. You can see an individual there walking, so you get an idea of the scale of how large this feature was. The folks at the engineering down there were interested in getting some numbers to help them repair the dam, and they asked us to come down. And the T-Hawk was flown with a point-shoot camera on it. There's a T-Hawk, again, the flying trash can. And we flew this, and you can see here, here's a model with one-foot contours that we generated from the stereo-collected photography. And here is a side image showing the breach. They did end up successfully using the imagery to do their engineering plans for the redesign, and we have flown since then to do some checks on the post-repair dam situation. The Big Bend of the Milk area of critical environmental concern is a cultural site. A lot of our BLM-related activities focus on cultural and paleo-type issues. This was a very unique project in which the first time I believe it was done, there was a prescribed fire on these two sites in the Big Bend cultural area of critical environmental concern, and in which they did a burn to clear the overgrown vegetation so that you could see some of these cultural features that they wanted to look at. It's a buffalo kill site, drive lines, a variety of ground features, habitation areas, medicine wheels. And so the fire was prescribed. Fire was approved, and they went ahead and cleared the veg. And then we flew with one of our UASs, and you can see here is some of the feature extraction. Well, let me get my pointer for you. Some of the feature extraction work here. This was done. This is done automated in our software to pick out some of the cultural features of interest. And the archaeologists afterwards believe this work probably saved them several years of ground survey. And so it's a good example of the value of the equipment. As I mentioned before, paleo is another big thing for the BLM. We have done an enormous number of dinosaur track sites around the western United States. This was some work that was done at White Sands National Monument to look at some Pleistocene trackways. Those trackways are really kind of showing up from about 18,000 to 30,000 years ago, and it's primarily mammoth and a extinct camel species and saber-toothed cats were in this particular area. And you can see some of those mammoth trackways are pointed out in this slide here. And over here, you can see here is the trackway. This is the same picture, aerial perspective. These white bars that you see here, these are what we call our scale bars. We use these in order to calibrate the photography so that we can get it into make real-world measurements of what we're collecting. And again, a mammoth trackway along here. And you can see those footprints down here. Fairly substantial trackways discovered between 2007 and 2013, believed to be the largest area of exposed mammoth trackways in the United States. Last October, unfortunately, the Challis Field Office was destroyed by a fire. Very early in the morning. You can see the fire was unfortunately catastrophic, burned the entire building, and given some of the challenges that were going on with federal agencies and the occupation at the Malheur site in Oregon and other stuff that's gone on with the BLM agency, there was some significant concerns that this was an arson event. And we were asked to go out and bring one of our UAS equipment and fly the area to provide some information that they could use documentation as part of the investigation. So you're seeing a 3D model here. These are our points. It's a very, very dense point cloud, and shows the obviously significant damage to the Chalice Field Office. So getting into the more mine-related things, we'll talk here now. One of the projects that, as I mentioned, my colleague Jason Frell's abandoned mine lands expert here at the National Operations Center, was contacted by the Elko Field Office in Nevada to talk about the possibility of using UAS technology and imagery to be able to do some physical safety hazard evaluations of some AML features. These features are usually in inaccessible locations. Many of you have experience with this, I'm sure. Significant safety gear, rappelling are often the ways to get to these sites. Was it possible to use a UAS platform to capture fine spatial resolution imagery that would allow them to make a call on whether or not the feature did represent a physical safety hazard? So here's some examples of the imagery from the aircraft and a point-shoot camera. This was never intended to be stereo equipment or stereo collections to get 3D data, just more of the situational awareness kind of things. Obviously, you can see the features of interest here. Note the shadows. Shadows are a problem. Another shot, a variety of different stuff. Some of it's concealed by the vegetation. It's nice to have an aerial perspective. You see things from the air that you don't necessarily note from a ground-based perspective. Steep slopes, unstable ground, make getting to some of these locations very difficult. So after doing this, 28 of the 61 features were able to be validated by the UAS, which saved them, roughly half of the features were did not require further inspections. As I pointed out, the shadows are a big challenge. It's hard to tell how deep something is, whether or not right on the surface, or does it actually result in an adit or shaft that goes significantly down into the ground that could be a hazard? So the shadows are always a challenge. Photogrammetry is always challenged by shadows. We find ways to work around it. It was thought that from a situational awareness, the UAS imagery was very valuable, and they did use it to come up with plans for the folks that had to do the on-site inspections. You had the advantage of kind of knowing how to engage each one of those sites. And then interestingly as well, several new AML features were identified from the aerial surveys that were not previously included in the inventory. And then we'll talk about a couple of other sites here. And at this point in time, I'm really focused on volume. And start off with the Dogtown Mine site, which is in the area of the Tucson Field Office, and BLM has jurisdiction over it, and they have CERCLA authority. The Dogtown Mine was active in the mid-1800s to maybe the late 1960s, and from about 1948 to 1966, 125 tons of ore was removed, primarily interested in zinc, lead, and copper, silver materials at this site. And in about 2009, the BLM started looking at the site for contamination from heavy metals, and what types of remediation activities did they need to do at this particular site. the CERCLA evaluation was done, and they looked at five possible ways, everything from doing nothing to putting in erosional control features, riprap, and things like that. And ultimately, the decision was that they wanted to remove the tailing piles and the heavy materials. And we were asked to do this, come in and use our UAS equipment to do some volumetric measurements. We collect stereo imagery that allows us to extract 3D information. We can do that quite well. And the question was, they wanted to know how many truckloads of material did they have that they needed to remove, and they wanted to compare traditional survey methods with photogrammetrically derived survey methods. And so this is a very challenging thing, and for those of you that do this type of work, knowing what is the truth is not always an easy thing. What is the truth? Well, the traditional survey methods are done with a wheel on the ground, looking at angles of repose for particular materials. I'm sure many of you do this on a regular basis. Obviously, that method is not perfect. It has error bars associated with it, just the same way that the photogrammetric data does. But we don't have a good way, usually, of being able to tell which one was which one is more correct. Now, the photogrammetric methods are something we can do very quickly. And you can see in this case, based on what the traditional survey reported, was about 6,450 cubic yards of material. The photogrammetric survey was about 5,670 cubic yards. We were honestly disappointed that those numbers didn't match up a little bit better, but as I said, it's not possible always to be able to tell which one is correct unless you have very rigorous control. And that's really where we started to go to when we have very good 3D control for photo-identifiable locations in our imagery, we can get down to sub-centimeter levels of accuracy and precision. And so this was a learning experience, one of the first ones, and you can see this is the photogrammetrically derived piles of information, of the metal tailings, and up here was a 3D point cloud perspective of what those are. And ultimately, they did decide to remove the materials. So when we talk about volume in BLM, we really kind of have two different types of volume situations. And the first one is sort of what you saw looking at a pile, looking at a product pile, and trying to calculate a volume that would be used for production verification. The other type of activity is more of the multi-temporal type perspective, in which you have a date of information that we can derive a 3D surface from, and then comparing that against a later date and saying how much material has been cut, how much material has been filled. And so different than Kate's Iron Mountain, and I think it's funny, I've noticed there's lots of Iron Mountains. This must be a very common name for a mine or a quarry. This Iron Mountain site is in Canyon City, Colorado. The Royal Gorge Field Office has jurisdiction over this, and my colleague Stephanie Carter has been very proactive at trying to involve UAS technology into doing her production mine verification activities. And she did some baseline work and flew 20-something of her sites back in 2012 with what's called the digital mapping camera, the DMC. It's a Zeiss imaging piece of equipment flown on camera flown on a traditional fixed-wing aircraft. And here you're seeing an orthomosaic of that data. And the area that we're interested in is really right as I'm moving my box or my arrow around. This is the area of active mining. They do not do measuring and weighing on site here. That goes off site. And so What Stephanie has been wanting to do is she's been wanting to validate against the receipts that the operators provide how much material is coming out of this site. And so here was 2012, and then in 2015 we had a UAS flown activity with a Sony Alpha 5100 camera flown on top of it. And we were able to generate about 2 centimeter resolution, and it was about 8 centimeter spatial resolution for the 2012 data. So using our photogrammetric process, again, that's stereo imagery, and if you want to talk about that, it is way beyond the scope of this thing and topic all of itself, but please feel free to contact me if you would like to talk about the software we use and our photogrammetric methods. But we can use that stereo-derived imagery to stereo-collected imagery to derive surface models. And so here you see the surface model from the stereo imagery for the 2012 date and for the 2015 date, and a scale down here ranging from 2285 meters up to, thank you, Gene, if you're operating my pointer for me, up to 2315 meters. And here's the equipment that was used. As I said, we really have gone to the 3ER Solo and to that Falcon, but this was something that was done with Kansas State University's DJI S800 equipment. The camera payload includes the Sony A5100s. This one was set up with dual cameras for some testing that we did to be able to scale using two cameras at the same time. We got a paper that will eventually be coming out about that. Here's an A5100. It's a standard point-and-shoot camera that costs about $500. And then the ZI Imaging DMC, which is hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it's flown on a Cessna 441 Conquest, was the aircraft that was flying the ZI Imaging sensor at that time. Here's an idea of the kind of resolution that we get from a UAS project, fairly typical to get 2 1-centimeter, even sub-centimeter spatial resolutions. It's, again, as I mentioned it in earlier, it's very different animal than those of us who did traditional remote sensing for years with 30-meter Landsat pixels and the highest resolution commercial satellite information that comes in and now in the 25-centimeter range. You're still looking at a whole lot of detail, and unfortunately, the other thing is it creates an enormous amount of data. So back to the actual activity that we were doing. It's the mine site is shown here in the red. This is the area that Stephanie wanted to calculate the differences between the two dates. You can see that area is highlighted. We can go ahead and clip out that area from those surfaces that I showed a couple slides ago, and we can take the difference between those two slides. And one thing that is something that gets at some of the challenges that I mentioned with the Dogtown mine site, we're very focused now on looking at quantifying our errors. And our software, our photogrammetric software, allows us to get vertical aerial error information out of the software by introducing control that we have from GPS or from surveyors. And so you can see the vertical error for the first product is quite small, right? We're seeing 1 centimeter of error. It's actually very, very difficult to even quantify that, even with survey methods, because there is error in the survey methods. But 1 centimeter of error and about 4 centimeters of error, we can take that to a 95% confidence level by multiplying by 1.96. And so what I'm going to show next here is that we take these two errors of 2.2 centimeters and 7.6 centimeters and make a combined error, and that allows us to calculate upper and lower confidence intervals for the area where the mining activity occurred. And so if you think of it as a deterministic kind of thing, it's really not exactly the right word, but the most likely statistical outcome would be that about 13,484 cubic yards were removed from Stephanie's Iron Mountain site between the two dates that we looked at. But it could be that as little as 12,997 and as much as 13,972 cubic yards of material were removed. You see our delta information, average of about 2.9 meters of height difference in the locations, maximum of about 6.7 and a minimum of about 60 centimeters, where they probably piled some stuff up temporarily. So that is sort of the first type of stuff that we do for volumetrics. The second type is more of the calculate the size of an individual pile, so not the multi-temporal component of two dates. This is the Indian Sunset Quarry, also in the Royal Gorge Field Office jurisdiction down near Westcliff, Colorado. And the area that was of interest is this comma-shaped product pile here. This is rhyolite material being extracted from the side of the quarry here, piled up and waiting to be removed by truckload to go off and be weighed at the scales. You got another point-and-shoot camera, an A6000 camera was flown by a company called Leptron, and we were able to derive this surface model. You see an enormous amount of detail, again, 2.2 centimeters for the surface model. It's quite high resolution as far as the DEM is concerned. Here's a look at Leptron's piece of equipment. It's called an RDASS, Rapidly Deployable Aerial Surveillance System. We don't like the surveillance thing. That brings the wrong message, but that is the name of their equipment. As I said, they flew an A6000 Sony, and here's a point cloud looking easterly at that rhyolite product pile. We literally generate hundreds of millions of points that we can use to build mesh models and DEM surfaces from the photogrammetric software. Here is the 3D mesh model in which we take those point clouds and we generate analogous to a triangulated irregular network, a TIN. It's basically a surface of connecting all of those points from their nodes to make triangles or faces. And in the software, it's quite easy to delineate an area of interest, and so in this case we drew around our product pile, and we can clip this area out. It requires closing the hole, so we basically make a we make this pile with a bottom on it, if you will, and then run a calculation of that, and this resulted in about 11,300 cubic yards of material. And this is an operational type activity, something that we hope to in the long term be a significant part of the production verification. As I said, we hope the equipment essentially turns into field equipment. Lastly, we've just mentioned, can the work be contracted? And there's to say that this technology is exploding and the interest in it is exploding, I don't even think that does it justice. It is we've just seen a dramatic level of increase in the last couple of years in people that are doing this. And we are looking at combinations of using contracting services to collect data in conjunction with our own operations. You see there's, as of August 2016, there were 7,500 drone pilots, manufacturers, service providers, retailers that had what's called FAA Section 333 authorization or exemption. That was something that you had to have if you wanted to run a business other than being a hobbyist. The Part 107 FAA regulations replaced some of that FAA 333 requirements with a new set of requirements for operation of drones less than 55 pounds. And just to give you a little idea of it, in the first 30 days that the FAA released the their 107 information, there was over 300,000 people applied for a Part 107. So there's a lot of people doing it, and obviously the location of these things are centered around where people are, not surprisingly. So that's an overview of our program here at the BLM, and a discussion of some applications, and a very quick address of the volumetric activities that we do. And I'd be happy to take any questions, and feel free to reach out if you are more interested in the photogrammetric side of what we're doing, the software we're using, how we do it, and equipment. I'm more than happy to talk.
Excellent. Thanks, Brian, for a great presentation. We got a lot of interest with questions coming in as you were speaking, so we can try to answer some of those now. One of the questions we got, the person was noticing a lot of the examples that you were talking about, the sites seem to be in relatively open, remote environments. So have you had any experience using drones in sites that maybe have less of an open air, like where they have tree cover?
Well, we certainly have experience in places that have tree cover. I'll just tell you sort of a very, very quick thing that makes me laugh. When I started the BLM about 4 years ago, very first week I was on the job, I went with my boss, Matt Bobo, who's our geospatial section chief here, up to Montana to do some field work and site preparation for UAS activities. And he told me, and I said to him, that this is very wide open. There's not a lot going on here. And he said, well, we work for the BLM. And I kind of turned my head and said, well, I'm not sure what you mean. And he said, well, if there's trees there, the Forest Service has it. And if there's other areas of, you know, specific natural beauty and cultural heritage kinds of things, the National Park Service has it. We get everything else. And I thought, oh, well, the reality is that most of the BLM lands are sparsely vegetated. We have pinyon juniper canopy and things like that. And we certainly have done projects in those areas. Oregon does have some BLM lands, and we've done some projects there. But heavily treed areas, you do have problems seeing the ground. We primarily are interested in seeing what's on the ground. And so it's not so much a thing that the equipment can't do it, from an operational standpoint, it's that the data that we can collect isn't always appropriate with these types of equipment.
Okay, that makes sense. I guess similarly related to that question, just in that you were giving examples that seem to be in remote locations, is there any experience that you can talk about in using drones in areas that are more populated, for example, like where residents might see them and be asking questions about what's going on, why is this thing flying around in the air?
Well, I knew that one was coming, and I know it's a primary concern for our program. It's a concern for the public, and it's part of the challenge. Again, BLM lands where we primarily operate are in relatively remote locations, don't tend to have populated areas anywhere near them. And so to answer the question, we don't do very much where we would actually be flying over structures that are inhabited, and we try to stay away from those types of things. Outreach is an incredibly important part of what our program does. We don't just fly. We plan, and we contact local people through different outreach channels, and so that there is not the perception that, hey, the government is operating this equipment. They're flying it over my backyard. Why are they doing that? Why are they trying to invade my privacy? What are they looking for? And all those kinds of things. We've actually been, I think it's been a really neat process in which there really is a lot of interest from the public. And when the explanation comes out from the PR people and then the pilots and the staff that are involved, it's usually made pretty clear that we're not there to do any surveillance. We're there for a natural resource, cultural resource, type activities, and most people show a lot of interest and ask questions and are very cooperative. I know EPA has challenges. You're flying over private land is entirely different than flying over publicly managed lands, which is what BLM, USGS, and a lot of our partners are doing. Does that kind of help?
Yes, that was a very good response. Thank you. We had a question just about the capability of drones. Are there some that can go underground to go look at some of the abandoned mine lands, looking at the line of sight versus a signal of some sort? This person indicated that this might be valuable for doing volumetric type analysis.
So that's a fantastic question, and it's a timely question. We very recently were contacted by a field office who has a problem that they have an adit that's about 150 feet long, and they need to go inside and, let me back up. They would have liked to have gone inside to document what is some man-made art features that had been scribed on the walls of the adit. Unfortunately, it has been confirmed that there is the presence of Hanta in that adit, and so people are not allowed to go in. And it's a combination of course, nobody wants exposure to the Hanta virus, but it's also a problem that it's structurally unsafe. We put out as a request for information an RFI to a wide swath of vendors about what kind of equipment would be possible to get in there, unmanned equipment, and what types of sensors would they be able to deploy on that equipment, and some kinds of ideas of what the cost would be. We got a lot of responses from small companies all the way up to larger geospatial firms that have everything from robotic-driven, like tank kinds of things, to one guy that was going to put together just a simple remote-controlled car and put a camera on it. Everything from, as I said, the camera, simple cameras, to LIDAR instruments, to radar instruments, all kinds of stuff. So the geophysical community was definitely the ones that that engaged. Unfortunately, our budget was not anywhere near what some of those companies were proposing, which some of them were in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. You think about that to do 150 foot long adit, that's a lot of money. So at this point in time, we haven't resolved that problem.
Okay, thank you. We got a number of questions from a participant who is curious if you've done any work with FEMA on long-term disaster recovery or emergency response type situations. And if not, or if so, like, can your shop be used in such situations?
So with respect to FEMA, I know that there have been things done. I can't pull off the top of my head exactly what those are. Emergency response activities have. Now, I come from a coastal management background. I was a LIDAR person at the Office for Coastal Management in Charleston, and involved in disaster related activities of a very different animal than the kind of stuff that we do. Most of our emergency related activities are more landslide related things. We've done a couple of things to look at post-fire for structures. I showed that one example. Our equipment, and here's something that's probably of value to folks. We didn't talk a whole lot about it. I mentioned it. The 3DR Solo is probably capable of doing about, you had a crew of two guys and a week worth of surveying work with the equipment. We can probably map about 700, 800 acres of land, and that gets us down that centimeter levels of resolution and high-quality 3D products. big time problem once you start getting into larger areas. As I said, it's a bunch of time, and it's just astronomical numbers of bytes of information that you're gathering. We don't currently, our shop, have larger UASs that are more appropriate for those types of. So if you were talking about large coastline swaths or things like that following a hurricane type situation in the southeast, you were talking about a situation after an earthquake type thing, there's going to be much larger UAS that are going to be operated by either Department of Homeland Security or the military, the Scan Eagles, those kinds of things, large aircraft that have endurance to stay up for hours, a whole suite of camera equipment. It's just a different kind of thing. We're very local in our approach. Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you. I think we have time to ask you one more question.
Sure.
So if someone has already done an environmental assessment at their site, could you describe how they would use a drone for further assessments and if it would make sense to do that?
Could you give me a little bit of a better idea of when you say an environmental assessment, what specifically it would be that you'd be talking about?
So in this example, they talked about doing a scan for archaeological features after their environmental assessment was done.
Well, sure. I think, you could certainly go back in and you can always image an area as long as we're meeting our safety requirements and we're not we have the appropriate permissions, we're not up in the airspace when other aircraft are in the area, we can always image. And there's one thing that doesn't get talked a lot about with respect to this thing is you're generating a permanent record by doing this, and the image the imagery that we collected is part of the rules for data records. We required to keep that information. You can always go back and you can look at it. You can recreate products. And so even if you had what was considered a baseline environmental assessment, again, following this idea of cultural features, it's always possible to go back and collect additional information, make sure you validate that the traditional survey methods or whatever ground-based approach was used to inventory and document that stuff. You have a different perspective. Anybody who's spent any time looking at aerial perspective knows that you will see something. It's literally, obviously, but you see different things when you look at something from a vertical perspective. So sure, you could absolutely go back, and I think it presents a lot of value.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Brian, for your presentation and for answering all the questions that we got from our participants. I think this was very well received and did an excellent job, and thank you so much for participating in this webinar. I am going to turn things back over to Rosalind Ramsey, who's going to summarize our FRTR series and move towards wrapping up today's webinar.
Thanks, Michelle, and thank you so much, Kate and Brian, for your time and participation today, and thanks everyone who did participate online in the webinar. I just want to remind you of the previous webinars in this series that are now archived, and if you click the link on this slide, you can get to these archives. Just as a reminder, session one was the risk assessment for mercury releases to the Kuskokwim River from BLM Red Devil Mine Site in Alaska, presented by Dr. Doug Cox and Dr. Angela Mack. Session two were two presentations done by, the first was anaerobic biochemical reactor treatment of mining influenced water by Barbara Butler, and the second one was aqueous geochemical modeling to evaluate metal-laden discharges from coal mines by Charles A. Cravata. So please feel free to go to those archives and watch these webinars if you were not able to attend, or rewatch them. And then keep an eye on the Clue in Mining page for upcoming webinars this fall. And I'll send it to Jean.
All right, let's go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders to close things out today. One of the common questions we get are people looking for training certificates or records. If you visit the CLUIN participation records page at the following URL, you can actually enter in your own email address, and we will email you a table of all of the webinars that you have actively participated on through CLUIN. If you take time to browse through the resources, you will find that a number of links and some of the slide materials have been made available to download from our resources page. If you're watching this as a recorded archive, you can still click the links to access those materials. And I will ask if you could each take just a moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought about today's session, both in how we delivered it and the content that was covered. If you happen to participate in a group, each person can fill out their own feedback form. And one of the pluses of providing feedback, there's a box you can check on that form, and when you send your feedback in with that box checked, you will have access to print out or save a participation certificate for your own records. Even if you're replaying the archive version, you can still give us feedback and download.